I'm so fucking sick and tired of the Photoshop. Show me something natural like Afro with your bra. Show me something natural like ass with some stretch marks. Still a tank you down right on your mama.
A podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me Cece, and I'm joined by my partner in organizing, Denise. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning.
We're back after the holiday season. Did you have a good break?
I was sick the whole break. So if you want to call lying in bed, being sick, sniffles, good. Yeah. But nah, I didn't do much over the break because I was sick.
What kind of weather are you having in Vienna?
Well, we had straight up winter frost.
Oops.
Yesterday.
Oops.
We had the Vienna famous spring frost. So that was new and interesting. I had to bring all my little plants in, bring my little worms in for my vermicomposting. You know. What you talking about? Ooh, it don't stink.
I didn't say it stinks. The worms, though? They're supposed to be outside.
Yeah, but you can't have them freezing. So in the winter, they come inside. And then, because, I mean, I'm on a terrace. I don't have underground for them to burrow in. So I take care of them. And how was your holiday?
No.
I'll send you some.
Nope. Not
Express
interested.
Mail, right? You want some, right?
I'm all
Look,
good.
You don't got to take your compost down. You do it right there on your balconies.
Great. Cool. We're good. We're good. My holidays were fine. I had guests. They were lovely. Wonderful guests. Some of the best guests I've ever had. And we had okay weather in London. But mostly I rested and ate a lot, as one should.
Yes, yes.
To kick things off today, I wanted to talk about two separate lists that came out. So Essence put out a Woke 100 list in their May 2017 issue. And, you know, there's some names on there that many of us are familiar with, like Shonda Rhimes, Zendaya. And then there are some names that some people might be less familiar with, like Kim Worthy, who is a Wayne County, Michigan prosecutor, or Monique Woodard. I'm very familiar with her because she's dope. A venture partner in 500 startups. Then there are like some other people who I was kind of like, how do we know that they're actually woke?
Who's in the gray area for you? Who's in the gray?
I don't want to say any names because I don't want to make nobody mad.
Okay, but you know, it's inevitable. So, because we got to know what you're talking about. Come on.
I was really excited to see Aduka Utah in there from Harriet's Apothecary, but yeah, there were just some people. How did you feel about the list?
I felt like the list was good and it had a nice mixture of people who are woke by how they've decided to do their jobs and who are woke by virtue of like they have a platform because they're a celebrity, like Zendaya. But they're trying to do something with that platform.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the other type of people like BLM activists that are 100% fully in it. I think though, it was so large, and I get now why they did that, but it was so large that it was a lot to take in.
Well, like, how do you go about choosing the like woke 100 though?
It's a lot. That's a lot. I feel
like, how do you like, how do you measure wokeness?
Sure. And I wish that they had picked a different name for it because it kind of feels competitive, right? Like 50 most beautiful people, because that's what we're used to seeing from magazines, is that if you're going to highlight X amount of people, it's about the people that are the most something. It's a superlative kind of identification. It's not like, you know, these are just people you should be looking at if you haven't looked at them. We're highlighting some things. It's like, this is the best of the best, right?
Yes.
And I think that that level of competitive nature in wokeology is dangerous. It's really dangerous because it leads to a lot of ego. I'm glad that I'm discovering people. Yeah, it can. But it does, though, right? Especially that we live in a celebrity culture.
Right. Well, I guess for me, for example, I was really excited to see Abby Isholo on there. She's the person who started the blog Beyond Classically Beautiful. We sat next to each other on a train coming back from Paris. That's how we met. She is amazing. She supports a lot of the things that I do. I was really excited to see her on there. She started that blog after Viola Davis was called not classically beautiful in that, you know, article that none of us will ever forget in the New York Times. And she's been very successful since then. But on the other hand, you know, there's a certain Lovey on the list.
Okay, see.
And, you know, there was a little, there's some beef going on with Lovey recently where I had to kind of wonder, I don't know if Shonda perhaps has tapped her on the shoulder since all of that happened, but, you know, she was coming for some people that have like a long list, high pile of receipts of all the things and all the work that they're doing, the real activist work that they're doing, that they're putting in. And she was saying, you know, that those people aren't activists. They just talk a good game and they just want to stay oppressed and they will find oppression in everything and every action. Whereas people like her are actually in them streets. And I was like, I don't know, Lovey, what streets are you in, though?
Yeah, she became a Nigerian auntie for a minute, like your unwoke Nigerian auntie who always got a man for you. Right? Like, became, like, he's a very good man, though. You know, like, she became that person. Just, you know, we channel it. And so she got called on it. She got dragged. She did a fake apology. And then she came back and tried to hit up on a real apology. She attempted a real apology. She did. So she did a fake apology on her blog and then she came back and updated it and was like, actually, some people have like pulled my collar and really had me see the light. And here's what I did wrong. Okay. Now, it still wasn't sufficient for some people, you know, like they want to be like, I have drafted it. You need to sign it, you know, kind of thing. And I don't want to belittle like what she did. It wasn't okay. It wasn't right. The thing about woke, though, and that as a definition, is that it's associated with almost like a perfection that these people have evolved on their ideals on all things. There are a lot of people on this list that I'm sure are homophobic, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people on this list, not a lot, but, you know, there are some people, let's say, on this list that they just have blind spots. Lovey's got blind spots. Mm-hmm. And what do we expect from people that we put in this kind of, and this is the problem with celebrity culture when it comes to activism, is that, you know, people will disappoint us.
Of course.
So I think someone said this and I believe it's true. I don't know if MLK would have survived, you know, an internet, right? A Martin Luther King. Right? Like, I don't know if a Bernard Rustin would survive it today. I'm not sure if Ida B. Wells would be surviving these internet streets. I'm not sure. This is a totally different landscape where the level of exposure we have and the level of access we have to pour out our least evolved ideas and then have them get feedback is profound. We've just never lived in a time like this. And it's just bound to happen. That used to happen at the poker game, and now that's happening in front of the entire world.
Well, I think my issue with the woke thing is, one, are these rankings? Like, they have, like, numbers? Because I don't feel like you can rank wokeness, or at least not objectively. And then I also wondered, I just would like to know more about how they came to the conclusion. Because woke, for me, isn't like a destination that you arrive at and then you're woke.
Mm-hmm.
You have to continuously work and read and learn new things and then learn more things and then get told by somebody. And you know what I'm saying? So I'm just not sure that wokeness as such is something that should, you know, be listed. But then, you know, while I'm criticizing Essence, I had to go over to Time. Because as they do, they did their Time 100, the most influential people, and they have people they call pioneers, they have artists, they have leaders, they have people they call titans, they have icons. The cover was released. It's a beautiful cover with Viola Davis on it. She looks amazing, of course. And interestingly, the people that they have chosen on the list are then described by someone else. So either someone who's worked with them, who looks up to them, who's in their field, whatever. And, you know, the list is challenging for many reasons, but We'll get to those. But it is interesting, for example, like Chance the Rapper, his little brief was written by Common. Jordan Peele's brief was written by Barry Jenkins. Tina Fey wrote the one on Donald Glover. As many of you know, Donald Glover was a writer on Tina Fey's show, 30 Rock, while he was still in college, living in a dorm, working as an RA. So there are some, they've given thought to the people who have written these briefs on the different people. But when I see names like Ivanka Trump or Jared Kushner.
Well, it's just about influence.
It's about influence. It is about influence. And, Ivanka has received for no discernible reason an office in the West Wing. So apparently she has some influence. She getting daddy to drop bombs over what he considered Baghdad, but it wasn't Baghdad. He had to be corrected on that. It was Syria. It just seems like, again, like, how are these lists made? Why are they important? And what purpose do they serve?
You have to realize that Hitler would have been on this list, right? Like, in his time, if time was around, Hitler would have been one of these people. He might have been on the top of the list.
Hitler did top the list on time during his time. So.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Archival.
Okay, Sean Spicer. Look, I'm going to need you to be prepared before you come to the press.
Didn't time just start? No, I'm just kidding. But I mean, some other problematic names include Theresa May, Donald Trump, Julian Assange, Vladimir Putin.
I don't know that those are problematic in the same way, right? These are people. Yeah. Theresa May leads a nation, 45th something. And Putin also leads a very, well, still searching for its old power nation. So there, I don't find those as questionable as someone like Ivanka, who doesn't actually even have a job title. I'm not sure.
Well, hey, I wouldn't be surprised to find Kardashian on here. And you feel me? Like,
they've lost some of their influence.
Let's hope so. But I'm feeling like influence is this thing that doesn't necessarily have to be tied to a tangible thing that you do, especially the way that influence is peddled right now.
And what do you think about, someone like Tina Fey writing the brief for Donald Glover, or Russell Crowe writing it for Leslie Jones, or Kathryn Bigelow writing it for Barry Jenkins, even though that is a connection I can somewhat see?
I kind of like that. I kind of like this kind of, there are things that people would say about you that you wouldn't say about yourself. And there are things that they see in you that you wouldn't see in yourself. And so you have people that have enough experience with the person that they have really known the person. But that lens is just going to be undeniable, because you seeing that person now through another lens it's going to definitely shift how the story gets told, as we saw with the latest Dolezal article that I loved. But it just does. I mean, that lens is going to be undeniable. And it's especially for me problematic a bit with the few Black people that are on the list, because we generally see Black people through a white lens. We generally see people that are marginalized through a mainstream lens. And so then here we have it again.
But who would you have? You have Common describing Chance the Rapper, right? They're both from Chicago. They're both rappers. They're both artists, and so on and so forth. Makes sense, right?
I'm looking right. That's nice.
Kathryn Bigelow to describe Barry Jenkins probably has to do with the fact that Kathryn was, the first woman to be honored with an Oscar in direction. Venus Williams. I'm not sure her connection to Ava DuVernay. I'm not sure about that. So. Maybe sometimes, maybe the connection is somewhere else. I don't know about
Russell Crowe. Is this like a constellation? Is this a constellation prize? Like, Venus, you to win, but we're going to need you to write by Ava. I don't know. Why is Ed Sheeran on there? I don't understand some of these people.
Because he has stolen from all Black people to make his albums. And he has now backpedaled.
Okay.
To give them credits where credit is due. He did give Tiny and Candy Burris credit for one of his songs that was basically a song that they wrote. Mm. So he said he was inspired.
I'm going to need him to go to the special green room with Tom Brady. Like, they could just go somewhere with all that. I'm not sitting.
But why are these lists important? Why do we need these today? Do we need them?
I don't need them.
I don't either. I'm wondering why they still get made, though.
Oh, magazines got to sell. I mean, I imagine magazine business is rough right now. And so this is what they've always done. And so that's what they have to continue to do. They got to put Margot Robbie on the list, right? Like, I don't even know why. But, you know, that's what they have to continue to do. But it has nothing to do with, okay, people need. I think media is so vast right now that there's very little that we need. It's about people trying to define their outlet as the definitive source for something. And so having this place where you're like, okay, we determine, we're kind of like all news that fits the print, or all news that all people that are that you need to be looking at. That's what Time is trying to do. They're trying to carve out their little cornerstone that they have because of their history.
Okay. Well, since you mentioned it, briefly tell us what you found special about IGOMA's article on thestranger.com, The Heart of Whiteness, where IGOMA Oluwa interviewed Rachel Dolezal. Why was this important?
I loved it because it wasn't an interview in the sense of like, here's the question and then here's the answer. I think that Rachel has been given so much platform to kind of like have her voice be heard. And it's unwarranted because here you have a white woman talking about Black womanhood in a way that is completely offensive and racist, right? But she's been given a platform to do so. It's, to me, I see no difference in giving Richard Spencer a platform and Rachel Dolezal a platform. They're both racists. And they get to talk about, because of their platform, have this kind of authoritative spiel about Blackness in a way that is unwarranted and unconscionable, actually. So instead of it being a conventional interview like that, what I really loved was the format. The format was first person, IGOMA talking about her experience of being this Black woman sitting across from this Rachel Faker, right? Like Rachel Dolezal, whose internalization of racism and white supremacy has been to commodify Blackness onto her own body, right? And to commit acts of fraud and go ahead of herself with this kind of fraud and use it to get things like book deals and positions and all of these things, while at the same time being really clear about her whiteness, right? So she's not confused. I think people give her way too much leeway in saying, oh, she's confused. And that's all because people are used to this victimizing white women in this way that isn't warranted. That being said, it's all about her. It's all about IGOMA's perception. And that is what was different about it. We've never seen a major publication print a long form piece about Rachel, through the Black gaze, and such an intimate, informed, well-studied Black gaze, someone who has written books about race and has lived this life. And that was what was just resonated with me. Like, I don't want to hear Richard Spencer talk, but I would hear, Ava DuVernay talk about Richard Spencer. I would do that, but I would not, he's had already too much time. And that was the feeling, that sense of exhale that I think a lot of people had with this piece, was like, everyone has given her so much time. You would never do this with another community. Like, you would never have a Holocaust denier, you know, like doing like a national tour and never ever have Jewish voices hone in on that and be spotlighted. So that was awesome. That was awesome. And it confirms for me something that I've always believed about Rachel, in that she just hates Black women. She does. She just hates them. Because I can't imagine any white woman that would parody us in this way having any level of love for us. And it it echoes something that Rosa Clemente said about when she came to Washington State for some dinner or something, and Rachel, in her official NAACP capacity, had to sit with her and had to greet her and everything, and just treated her absolutely horrible. And this was before anything came out, that she was just like, it was clear to me that this was not someone that loved Black women. That's what Rosa Clemente said about Rachel Dolezal. And Rachel even challenged Rosa Clemente's Blackness as an Afro-Latina person. So this is this Blackness that she tries to wield for herself is actually just a club. It's a club that she likes to beat Black people up with. And Ijeoma highlighted that and read it for what it was. And I absolutely love that piece.
And in our second segment today, I have the pleasure of interviewing, speaking with, discussing with the beautiful Dr. Olumide Popuola, who is an author who is, well, I'd call you a poet. I don't know if you still go by that title. Who's also a mother and all the beautiful things. Welcome and thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be part of today's session.
Of course, I want to talk to you about your book that's releasing soon, When We Speak of Nothing. Mm-hmm. But how about you just tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do?
Okay, so I'm a Nigerian-German writer. I moved to London about 14 years ago. And yeah, I write all sorts of things from fiction to poetry. I've written a play. Also a lecture creative writing or in creative writing. And these days I write mostly fiction, short and long, but preferably novels. So I have a novel coming out. And I'm a mother to a beautiful 9-month-old who is sleeping on my back at the moment. And we all have a cold. So.
Oh, no.
Yeah, just art, which is fun with a toddler with a baby. But yeah, that's what I do.
So When We Speak of Nothing, when will it be released?
July the 3rd.
July the 3rd. And where can we find it?
You can pre-order it now from either Wordry or the bigger bookstores or Amazon if you must. And then hopefully it will be in a few bookshops after July the 3rd. You can also order from the publisher directly, Cassava Republic.
And the book, is it only going to be released in the UK to begin with, or?
It's coming out in the UK first, and then later in the year in Nigeria.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. And When We Speak of Nothing, what is it about?
It's a novel about friendship and loyalty, but it has a lot of other undercurrents. So it has some queer undercurrents. It's set against the backdrop of the London riots and also friction or issues in the Niger Delta in Nigeria, so around oil devastation and activism there. Also about youth culture, what it might mean to be young, especially during the times of the cuts or the austerity measures in Britain when a lot of things changed. And then it's about gentrification in the King's Cross area, but those are sort of the backdrop. That's where we find ourselves in. But this sort of larger themes are how you negotiate friendship and loyalty.
And why was it important to you to write about or to have the book set in this quite, you know, surprisingly disruptive time after the riots?
I was working in a youth center just behind King's Cross. So it's really maybe I set the novel a street parallel to where I work. And then actually the riots happened. So it's just really inspired from my time there when things were changing, the facilities for young people were changing. Yeah, and then the riots happened. And I was wondering who of the young people that I knew were going to go to Hackney or wherever. I didn't quite reach King's Cross. So it was an interesting time. You couldn't not write about it. I started the novel before the riots, but when they happened, obviously it had to be included.
Mm-hmm. For someone who was living in London during the riots and as you said, working with young people, how did you find yourself affected by them?
I had just come back. I'd been away for a while, actually on residencies. And I think I had just come back and I wasn't working with young people. I was working in a youth center, but I was actually a receptionist. So I wasn't responsible for them, but you got to speaking to them a lot. I don't know how was that affected. I think it is an interesting time. And the analysis was very interesting, whether this was about racial issues or whether this was about class issues or whether this was about the country changing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and that's what you do as a writer, I guess, or what I do. You think through things. It's a great opportunity in a novel to think. I didn't get very far, so there's no sort of analysis and what I think the riots were about in a sense. But there are attempts at looking at it. I don't know what else to say really, because I think it was an interesting time and there were different elements to it. Obviously, there was Mark Dagen, and that, mm-hmm. I think that was real political response, and that's the initiator. And then it sort of had its own momentum and it became something completely different altogether. And I think there was quite a lot of opportunities for people jumping on the bandwagon, and then some embarrassing things.
Of course.
You know. But I think there were political elements within that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it as a whole? It's too complex maybe to answer.
Mm-hmm. And the queer themes, how do you connect or will the queer, without giving too much away, let's say, are the queer themes, is it a major part of the book, or is it kind of presented as something normal?
It's something normal. I mean, I can talk about it. One of the characters, a trans man, and that's as far as it goes. There is no huge discussion around that. It does surface, and there are issues and people he has to talk to, and it might not always go really well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's much more about being young at that certain time. And this is just one of the characters, and it's one of the protagonists, the two protagonists, Carl and Abu, who are best friends. And mm-hmm. the stories are centered around their friendship. So it is something that just is. I would like to think. I'd like to think that it's not, oh, look, let me help you understand some sort of queer people or something. I'm not really interested in that. But to be truthful, you also have to represent some of the difficulties and transphobia or queerphobia that people have to deal with.
And do you expect any particular response when the book is then published and released in Nigeria?
I expect them to love it and say, okay, now we get it. Thank you so much. We were ignorant. Let's repeal the kill the gay law. Mm-hmm. That's what I expect. And I can't wait. And then I'll say, of course, it wasn't me. I don't know what to expect, if I'm honest. I have no idea. So I think, yes, of course, people like us will embrace it and be happy. Then hopefully there will also be some real kind of criticism that is not just based on whether queer or not, but just on the quality of the novel itself, on the content, in the writing. And that would be, yeah, many people will think it's completely insignificant. One thing I do expect is that because I am of dual heritage and mostly brought up in Germany, that I will be dismissed, that my Nigerianness will be dismissed. That's something I expect.
Mm-hmm.
That's of course, she. But as Nigerians, we are not really trans or queer. That's just a Western thing. I expect some of that.
Okay. Do you plan to tour at all in Nigeria?
I'm supposed to go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely for launch and for a few appearances. But it depends a bit more on my little daughter at the moment and how things go.
Is there, I mean, obviously, the timeline of a book being published or released has very little to do with when it was actually written. But I know that something that I've read from you previously, Breach, which was a book of short stories that you wrote with a second author. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the experience of going to the refugee camp in Calais and speaking with people and then taking those experiences and those conversations and creating fictionalized stories about very real circumstances, if you would say that was a completely different experience from what you've done now and when we speak of nothing?
No, it hasn't actually. I think the difference was that it was a commission and that the editor had a lot more say over the development, and she was quite involved, which was a good thing. But I had written When We Speak of Nothing before that, and I'd also went to the Niger Delta and mm-hmm. spoke to people, and I looked at things. So also to be able to write about Port Harcourt, I had to go there and I wanted to see things. So I didn't base it on people that I met, but the same in Breach, it's an amalgamation of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not actually so different to what I do or what I like to do, which you'd have to do research either way. And if a place is easily accessible, why not just go and experience them rather than just making it up without ever having been there? So equally, obviously, I spoke to trans people and about certain issues in the book, not mm-hmm. just in general. I think it's part of general research you do for fiction. And that's what I do.
And what do you think your personal experience as someone who, as you say, comes from a dual heritage, is Nigerian-German, identifies as Black, identifies as queer. What do you think that those particular parts of you bring to your writing?
Different perspectives, obviously. I won't say I'm fluent in different cultural contexts, but a little bit accustomed to in different cultural contexts. And I include Britain here as well, because I've been here for a long time. And because you're sort of, you know, always a little bit on the outside, which is always a good position for a writer, I think, because we are observing and reflecting on things in a way. So I guess, yeah, that's what I bring in terms of the other things. It's just the themes that I tackle. So that's why when you're coming back to your earlier question, whether queerness was presented as normal, because it is normal to me. It is not sensational or something that we're doing because the law has changed and now we all want to be PC. I try to write about characters, how I experience them or how I wanted them imagined. So I guess you bring your experience to everything. I don't know if that answers your question.
I think it answers my question. The reason I ask is because sometimes artists, writers, and so forth are challenged in a way. For example, someone asked Issa Rae, does she feel responsible for portraying Black people in a certain way on Insecure as to not perpetuate certain stereotypes? And she said, I'm just telling stories. And I think oftentimes the conversation becomes, especially with Black people, you know, oh, but if we tell a story this way, then we're perpetuating a certain theme or cliche or stereotype. And I think the same thing exists in queer circles, that people worry if a drag queen is portrayed in a certain way, or if a Black queer man is portrayed in a certain way, that people will assume, as they do, that that's how all Black queer men are. That's how all Black gay men are. Or that's how all whatever are.
I think it's always good to ask your intentions, why you are portraying characters in a certain way. I think everything is, as a writer, it must be possible to tackle any subject or any kind of character, because you're always imagining outside of yourself, because otherwise it's not fiction. So even if you're using yourself, even if I write about a dual heritage person, it's not myself, otherwise it's a memoir. So you must be able to do that. There must be space, but I think you have to assess your intentions, and you maybe ask yourself a few questions. And I think research is important. If you're portraying somebody in a stereotypical way, why is that necessary? So, okay, I know creative writing very well from university context. And if you go to visual arts in a university context, as far as I know, they do a lot around representation and images and what you put out there. And I think it's actually very good practice for a writer to sort of do the same. What is the image that I'm throwing out there? What purpose does it serve? And why might I be doing it? And then if you can answer those truthfully, then, and maybe have good answers, then maybe that's okay. Because then maybe you're not perpetuating stereotypes. Because on the other hand, yes, you must also tell a good story. You can't leave out everything and or make everybody a righteous activist who is changing the world, because those stories would also be boring and they would also not reflect the human condition, which I think as storytellers, that's what we do. We write about the human condition.
Just one last question. Why would you like for people to read When We Speak of Nothing?
Because it's brilliant. Give it a try and see. Okay, this is why. This is the real reason. Because I think what I've tried to do is subvert certain expectations. So around queer or trans issues, people have this idea that we in the West are so far advanced. And I think that goes both ways. People from the West themselves, also including queer people, and people from, let's say, Nigeria, because I wrote about Nigeria in this context. And I try to subvert that story in there to say, actually, culturally, it has always sort of been inherently possible. I don't know if that's the right way of putting it. I'm very specific, in the Yoruba culture, there is something that leads us back to mythology where we can draw on, that actually has space for queerness. And I put queerness there because all sorts of, that goes away from sort of heteronormativity and also essentialism of gender. And that's why I would like for people to read it, because I think you find a different approach there if you look closely.
Well, thank you so much. For our listeners, just one more time, the book is When We Speak of Nothing. You can pre-order it now. It will be released on July 3rd by Cassava Republic Press. And the author, Olumide Popoola, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Steve. Wonderful speaking to you.
And in our third segment, what are we excited about? What are we looking forward to? What's going on your end?
Okay, you go first, because I don't want to have the same thing.
I'm sure we don't have the same thing.
Ooh,
mine is specific to London.
Ooh, okay, specific to London. Very good, very good. So Dear White People premieres on Netflix on April 28th. And so the movie Dear White People had its shortcomings that I'm hoping will be fleshed out and explored in the series. So that's really exciting.
It is.
Get Out premieres in Vienna.
Oh, so,
I know, finally, right?
Well, at least it's coming.
At least, finally, finally. We have a queer space here called the Rosalila Villa, and it's a massive building, and they put on performances. There's a bar on the bottom, and there's an office there called Queer Base. Queer Base has started having Thursdays as POC social nights, and so that's been huge to have more POC queer spaces opening up in Vienna. So that's been dope. And what are you looking forward to?
Well, tomorrow is a big voguing ball. JJ Reblon, who is well known here in London, he's a youngin, and he, you know, teaches classes and he does his thing. He's throwing his first own, very own ball that a lot of us are going to tomorrow. So I'm really excited about that. I think it's already sold out. We'll be heading there. And other than that, I'm still just reveling in the beauty that is Kendrick Lamar's Damn. I love the new album. I think it's super, super dope. I know he got dragged on Twitter. I haven't read all of the things about all of the things, but you know, everyone gets dragged on Twitter these days, so I have to take that with a grain of salt. I love the album. I think it's great. Thank you, Kendrick, for doing what you do. The music's dope. The lyrics are dope. He coming for all the people who came for him. And it must be a highlight right now. You know, he calls out Fox News for coming for him. And Luda, you know, he just sat back while Fast and the Furious 8 did $532 million in his first weekend, while Pepsi got dragged and Bill O'Reilly got fired. You know, Ludacris just sat back and was like, you remember?
What?
Because Bill O'Reilly had Pepsi. He asked his viewers to boycott Pepsi because Pepsi was working with Ludacris and Ludacris degrades women.
Mm.
Oh, the irony. So, yeah, so I'm excited about Kendrick Lamar's album. I'm excited about, you know, think people getting served where they should. And I'm excited about the voguing ball tomorrow.
Yes.
Well, that's all for this week. If you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today, so feel free to get at us. And check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/thequeertruth, and hit us up with a donation. Until next time, peace out.